Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery, code Wondery.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone, and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 757. Fun Comfortable Tour continues this coming weekend. That would be the 13th and 14th of November. I'll be in Kansas City, Missouri, and Phoenix on the 14th. So Kansas City Friday, Phoenix the 14th, with April Richardson. We'll be coming and doing Fun Comfortable Goodness then. And then a couple, handful of dates in January. And then the special tapes. Kind of excited to be done with that material because I'm already writing material for the next special and the next tour. So I'm excited. Things are fun, you guys. Things are just fun. Also fun, from the Nerdist Community Corkboard, this is from, which is events at Nerdist.com. Here's from a listener who didn't write their name. On Sunday, November 22nd, between 1:30 and 5, the 19th Annual Bowl-a-thon, oh, I like it, will be held in the Pottery Studio at the Creative Arts Workshop, 80 Audubon Street in New Haven, to support the work of the Community Soup Kitchen. Local artisans have generously donated handmade bowls, which can be acquired for a modest donation. Mugs and other items will be helpful. Hot soup will be served. Celebrate the change of the seasons while helping New Haven's hungry. Also, Nerdist listeners should consider volunteering a day in a local soup kitchen, and they're saying they promise that it will change you. And I'm 100% positive that that is the case, because when you contribute to other people, you feel good. You are rewarded because you are contributing to other people outside of yourself. This is a very positive thing. It says New Haven. I think it's Connecticut. It doesn't say, but if you live in a New Haven, just look it up. I guess Audubon Street would be the other giveaway. There's an Audubon Street in your New Haven. Good for you. Next one, DJ Walker writes, Chris is always inspiring us to get out there and create something. True. I mean, I try. I don't know if I'm inspiring you, but I certainly talk about it a lot. I figured since I just turned 51, all right, DJ, it might be time to finally fulfill a lifelong goal and self-publish a book. Good for you, man. My first effort is the very accurately titled A Short Book of Poems. You can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Word Smash. You know, I said good for you, man. I don't know if DJ is a dude or a lady. DJ could be DJ Tanner, huh? Good for you, 51-year-old dude or lady. It is never too late to start pursuing your thing. I'm very proud of you. This episode of the podcast is Stephen Moyer, who you may know from True Blood, but also he is now in a show called The Bastard Executioner. It's Tuesdays at 10 p.m. on FX. That's Kurt Sutter's new show. And yeah, Stephen Moyer was awesome. I mean, I guess it's probably silly for me to tell you that he was awesome when you were about to listen to this podcast and you were going to find that out for yourself. So on the one hand, I retract it, but I don't retract it on the other hand because it's still true. Here's Nerdist Podcast number 757 with Stephen Moyer.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Cardiff, because that's where they moved the Doctor Who Museum to.
That's exactly where it is.
Yeah, it used to be in like West Kensington or something, and then they moved it to, and I went to it there. And then it was really amazing because they, I don't know, they gave me a private tour of it, which I thought would be rad, until I got into the TARDIS control room, which was clearly an event designed for 50 people, and she still had to stand there and go,
Will anyone here save us from this threat? Like, because
other people are supposed to come in and reach in and move all the TARDIS, so I had to walk around by my... It was so sad. It just felt like this sad little boy.
Also, did you watch Young Doctor Who? Have you seen it from, like, or are you...
Well, you know, in America, we got Tom Baker.
Okay.
And so it wasn't until years later and the internet and everything where I was able to
go back and watch
some. And people always say, like, if I'm starting, where should I start? And I go, you know, maybe start in 2005 because older ones are a little bit slower.
Well, the reason I ask is because the TARDIS was, like, made of cardboard
right
back in the day. And here's a little bit of trivia, which I'm sure you know because you know shit like this. But, you know, Gotham.
Yeah.
You know that Sean Pertwee, who plays Alfred.
His father was John.
John Pertwee.
Yes.
And if you really want to watch something kind of bizarre, because he was my first Doctor Who.
Sure.
John Pertwee. And then second up is he did this show called Wurzel Gummidge.
Uh-huh.
And if you want to freak it, you should YouTube that shit because that is bananas.
Really?
Yeah.
Wurzel
Gummidge is about a scarecrow who comes to life. it's amazing. And kind of scary, actually.
I wonder if it's like our version of your version of H.R. Puffin stuff. There, we had these Sid and Marty Krofft cartoons, live action shows in the 60s and 70s. And it was like a fucking drug trip of weird animal creatures.
Well, it's really hard to describe it, but he kind of had all these things going on, and he'd just speak like this a little bit. And do you guys watch Sherlock?
Yeah, yes. Oh,
okay.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
So in Sherlock, Mrs. Higgins? What's the lady who's the...
She's their landlady, kind of? Yeah. What's her name? Is it Higgins?
She is played by a lady called Una Stubbs.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And Una Stubbs played this character called Aunt Polly. I think it was Aunt Polly, who is a China doll who only comes to life when Wurzel Gummidge sees her.
I am definitely going to watch the show.
And that was Una Stubbs.
And that, and you said Sean was this...
Sean's dad.
Oh, John was in there.
John was Wurzel Gummidge.
Oh my God, that's amazing. You know, the idea is your favorite doctor is usually the one that you saw when you were a kid.
Yeah.
So
I did like Tom Baker.
A lot of people like Tom. You know, he was the iconic one that we had over here. And then, you know, it wasn't until, I don't know, I guess maybe 15 years ago.
Have you seen like the Chris Eccleston version?
Oh, yeah. Eccleston and Tennant and Matt and Capaldi right now is amazing.
Capaldi, yeah.
And
I like Smithy a lot. I thought
Smith is great. They're all great. They're all great.
They're all their own thing, aren't they?
They are all their own thing. And that's what's so, they each bring a different side.
Yeah.
What a brilliant idea to... We can keep the show going forever.
Have you seen Capaldi do... did you see The Thick of It?
I saw pieces of The Thick of It. And that
in that is unbelievable.
I told him one of my favorite things I've ever heard on a show was the first episode of The Thick of It when he goes, that went over like a marzipan dildo.
Yeah.
Marzipan dildo?
Yeah.
What an amazing...
That's Armando.
Chunk of dialogue.
That's Armando Iannucci.
Armando Iannucci, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... And also amazing that he could go from that to playing what is ostensibly a younger person's show in Britain. Here, it's everyone watches it. But but in the early days, when America first started getting big into Doctor Who, and I would meet British people, they're like, oh, I love Doctor Who. That's a kid's show. You know, like they would get. But everyone's got.
Well, Russell changed that around. You know, Russell Davis just completely reinvented what it was and what it could be, and because it was being written by somebody who's as brilliant as him, you know, it had all of the historic idea, but it was, you know, Russell's a brilliant writer, so it was also kind of within a sort of modern scape as well, and because it's harking back to a life that we all know from when we were kids, it's suddenly completely accessible to grown-ups as well.
Sure. And also because there's a lot of TV shows, there's a lot of film and TV shows that needed to wait until the last 15 years to be made simply because of the special effects.
Yeah.
They just weren't, it just wasn't plausible in the 70s. Doctor Who was like black box theater and rubber
mats. You know, I was still scared of it though. I was utterly terrified. You ask any kid from the time and we'd be hiding behind bloody pillows. And it's so hilarious that you're scared of a Dalek that can't go upstairs.
Yeah.
But all you need to do is go upstairs.
Yeah.
And you're free.
Well, yeah, and then, you know, in general,
it's genius, isn't it?
In general, you can outrun a zombie. I mean, depending on who's writing the zombie lore, but in general,
you can't outrun hot zombies at Halloween, though.
No, no, they will chase you down.
Isn't hot the idea of a hot zombie just hilarious?
I mean, it is pretty amazing that Halloween equals let's make everything fuckable. Yeah,
yeah. No, I was talking about this last week. You know, it's like this moment where your kid goes from being cute Minnie Mouse to stripper Minnie Mouse, you know? and it happens way too early.
I'll take a lap dance. No, you won't.
Yeah.
So
you're gonna take the
Disneyland's
treat.
That's missing is there's just one like weird adult Disney. They can make it even
that
creepier.
Would be awesome.
It would be awesome.
Oh, did you hear about Dismaland?
No.
You didn't hear about Dismaland?
No.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, wait. Is
Banksy's
this
thing?
Yes.
Oh,
Banksy's, yeah.
God, it was
unbelievable. For some reason, I didn't know that's what... Did you see it?
I was there. Yeah, I went. Yeah, it was amazing.
It was amazing?
It was amazing.
Who's Banksy? Is it a dude or a bunch of dudes or a bunch of ladies?
If you really want to know, you can find out in about 17 seconds. Depending on how quick your fingers are, as it were.
But is it to be believed?
Well, I think I don't want to know though.
I don't either.
I know exactly who it is, but I don't want to.
Oh, you don't want to.
I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because I want to just think that it just happens.
It's sort of the magic of it.
Yeah,
like the magic of it is what makes it special and what makes it interesting. Yeah. I mean, it's.
Have we started, by the way?
Oh yeah, we started ages ago.
No, it's great.
I'm so all the stuff that I loved when I was growing up, and this is sort of the overtaking of nerd culture into the supposition of pop culture being taken over by nerd culture.
Discuss.
Yeah. But, you know, when I remember when True Blood came out and I was like, you know, when essentially our serialized programming is about vampires and witches and, you know, and this is our normal serialized programming, then our culture has won, you know?
I do feel like that, you know, obviously it's we can't pretend that Buffy never happened, but I think that Buffy was always slightly on the outskirts, if you like,
it was very niche
of the mainstream.
Yeah.
And yet when True Blood came along, it kind of was completely mainstream.
Yeah.
And Alan created this thing that normal people who would never have watched a genre show they would watch. And
this is Matt Myra. He's on the podcast.
I just flooded.
Hey, Matt.
You know, Matt, we just started a little bit early. Matt actually got here exactly on time.
Matt's on time.
Matt Myra, we don't have to talk about it too much. This guy just got back from his honeymoon.
I did.
Matt.
Yeah,
congratulations.
It was lovely.
You
all made.
You got a wedding ring.
I've got a ring and everything.
A ring. You got a ring. You don't have a ring.
Mine's coming next year.
That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right.
It happens.
It does happen. But I was talking about True Blood, and one of the things that always made me feel like complete, like, oh, this is Comic-Con, was getting into the elevators at the Hilton Bayfront and seeing wall-to-wall True Blood, those
huge
overlays.
And I loved that one of Anna where the bite was the button to press.
Yes.
Do you remember that?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
The bite on her neck was the button to press to get the elevator to go up.
So wonderful.
There was some really cool stuff.
You know, that show, I loved that show. Because it was so, I feel like that show went through so many different journeys.
Yeah, we didn't exactly jump the shark. We sort of jumped the ocean. And at the time when you're going through it,
you surprisingly didn't jump a group of people who turned into sharks.
Yes,
I was surprised. The sharks.
Where were the were sharks?
Where were the were sharks? Where were the were sharks?
Yeah,
you know, I've said this before.
I'm sure they must have thought about it.
I've said this before because Manganiello's been on and Kristen Bauer's been on and a lot of people have been on who were on the show, and
Sam the Tram.
Sam's been on the show, and I still, one of my favorite things of all time was how they built up an entire season to Jason Stackhouse being turned into a weirpanther.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, one episode, they're like, oh, don't work that way. And then it's never spoken of again.
Yeah.
It's never, never addressed again.
Yeah.
But but I love that, you know, in the first couple episodes, the hocus pocus is very minimal.
Yeah.
It's just more of this, like, this is an allegory about racism and
sexuality, anything that you wanted to bring to the party. And I think that, I honestly think that Alan was having so much fun. The writers were having so much fun.
Was he having a ball?
Sorry. That was great. I think all the writers were just like, let's try this, let's try that, let's throw this
against them. Absolutely.
You know, and it just, when you're kind of experiencing it and those scripts are coming in, you're just going, oh, great, this makes sense. And then you look back, you know, and I remember reading episode 12 of season 5, you know, and I think everybody had the same reaction. You know, Bill drinks the blood of Lilith and then literally goes into a pool of blood.
Yeah.
And then comes back as Billeth.
Right.
And it was Macmillan who phrased Billeth before it even come out. And you're just like, okay, I got to make this work now. And I was directing the first episode of season 6 dressed as Billeth,
you know, this giant
blood tampon and running, walking
around
on
set
directing. Well, no, it wasn't just a tampon, because a tampon is white.
Yes.
And it's made of cotton wool.
And Billeth
is not.
Is made of cotton, but...
Yeah, it's made of cotton, but red cotton.
Yeah, because that was definitely... Because the cliffhanger on that was like, well, how the fuck is Bill coming back from... Okay, all right. But then Bill... Then all of a sudden it's okay. Like...
Well, you know, it was one of those things, I think, where the writers were trying to just steer it back to some kind of sense of,
yeah,
of normality. I should have gone like that. But if you have a character who is completely indestructible with no kryptonite, you're fucked. You know, and so there has to be some sense of the kryptonite of the world, of whatever our world is. And if he's completely indestructible, you're screwed, aren't you?
Yeah, I was friends with one of the girls who was one of the blood sirens or whatever.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, yeah, we got to put on these crazy merkins, you know, to do these scenes.
Yeah.
They're just like strapping on the merkins and walking around in blood.
Yeah, there were more merkins in our trailer. There's just rows of them. It was unbelievable. And Bridget, amazing makeup, head of makeup, who was also on Buffy for 8 years.
Oh, awesome.
You know, they had to create them with hair. You know, they'd create merkins and sew them, and like as if you know, like the hair makers or wig makers, sure, or beard makers, you know, they were merkin makers.
What a fun, I mean, as a job, though, what a fun, I'm sure the hours were insane, but what a fun job to have.
It
just
was
to go
the
and...
most fun I think anybody had any right to have. And even when the show kind of, we weren't sure what it was or whether we felt like it was slightly going off center or derailing in some way, there was, you go and watch that show and it is fun.
It's fun.
It's never not fun.
Yeah.
And I really sort of take that with me now when I think back. And people used to come onto our set, and I'm sure Sam and Joe, you may have said this, but people used to come onto the set as guest artists and just go, oh my God, this is just hilarious. We had, it was a family of people laughing and doing good work and having the most awesome time all the time. And it was the kind of gig that everybody wanted to be on.
That's fantastic. And is it, so what are the dynamics and the sort of relationship politics of being married to your co-star and then seeing each other at home and seeing each, I mean, you guys, I mean, they, Bill and Sookie, like, they sort of went around each other a lot. But is it, you know, like, how do you divide up those two parts of your life and keep it normal?
I mean, it's we met on the show. So our normality was, you know, having sex in front of 70 people.
Right.
You know? And not that we went to choose to go and do that on Hollywood Boulevard, but,
sure,
but you know, that kind of intimacy that we shared in with our gang, our family, was incredibly normal, you know? So when we went home, I mean, I've said this before, but when we went home and we were in the privacy of our own home, we kind of missed them, you know.
Oh.
I am joking. Sorry, babe. Sorry. I know I've used that gag before. I'm sorry.
It's all right. Listen, A-list gags work. If they work, they work.
You know, it's like a stand-up comedian who works for 5 years getting 20 minutes and then finally goes on television and then they can never use any of their material again. You know?
Ah, well, there's a trick to that.
Don't go on television.
Well, you can do some of the same, you know, media is so splintered now, you can do some of the same jokes on other people's shows, but once you shoot your hour special, then you can't do those anymore.
It's the like, second album.
That gobbles up.
The second album and the second novel. And
yeah, I mean, I feel like musicians have it so much easier, and that, you know, the trade-off is, when a musician tours, they have to tour with a whole band and a setup and teams of people and trucks full of stuff. Comedian can just walk on stage. The trade-off is that once a musician writes a good song, they can fucking play that song forever.
Yeah.
And when a comedian writes a good joke,
you can't keep doing the joke.
You can't keep doing the joke over and over again.
Do the joke!
Rarely does that happen.
No. It does have your Monty Python. Monty Python get to do the same things a lot.
Of course. Of course. Because that's such a, you know, to see the parrot sketch or to see, you know, spam, spam, eggs.
Yeah.
To see that stuff over and over again, it's amazing to see them do it live. But with like a joke, with like stand-up jokes,
it's tough.
People have not a lot of patience for, I already saw that. Why am I paying for this?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Then pretend it's a song. Where were you when you heard it the first time?
Have you ever done, you guys have probably seen sitcoms being shot. The very first TV I ever did was I did 2 years on a sitcom in England. And sometimes a gag won't work, you know, or for whatever reason the camera didn't make it across at the right time, and you have to do the line again, and you've got somebody out front going, okay, now you're gonna laugh as this was the first time you've seen it, and 7 times later you've got this audience going ha ha with this deadpan faces, you know.
You're saying to the producers, can we use the laugh from the first time over the shot?
And that's exactly
worked?
What
yeah,
they do.
Of course.
Or they just open the can, you know.
I always say this to British television actors that I feel like, you know, that you never, like, do you ever feel like you have job security on British television? Because they will just do something for 6 episodes and then go, well, that's it.
I think it's a good question. I'd be interested to know what they say to you, because I think that one of the differences is at home is we, however far we get in our career, we absolutely never believe we're ever going to work again.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not something that I've come across in American actors. There's this sort of confidence about them that, you know, as soon as you're done, we think it's done. And there's, you know, it's like going back to square one.
Right.
I still believe it. I still have that sense. And I think it's one of the reasons that English actors, I think it's one of the reasons that directors like working with English actors, because they're so fucking happy to be there.
Sure.
Because it's like their first job.
Sure.
Every time.
Or it's why you see people like Michael Caine occasionally take a weird role. You're like, why did he do that? And then he's like, oh, well, I'm afraid.
I got offered it.
Yeah, I got offered it. I mean, I get offered work. What if I don't get offered work anymore?
Yeah, Michael Parkinson famously said to Michael Caine, you know, there's the good films, then there's the bad films, and then there's the swarm, which is heinous. And he said, my wife wanted a swimming pool that year.
There you go.
And there you go. What do I mean? That's the answer.
I think American performers feel that too. I just think that we're more full of shit. I don't know. I feel like there's more of
you sounded like Ron Burgundy then.
Stay classy. I think it is a false, you know, I don't know. I think there is a little bit of a
false bravado.
What are you talking about?
I mean, some of the time, maybe. I don't know. What are we talking about here?
I don't know. All I know is we're great.
Yeah. All I know is everything's perfect here
You think we're great, right?
Yeah, we're all the time. It's great all the time. Right?
Actually, I don't care whether you think we're great.
Yeah, I just,
yeah,
we are great.
It doesn't
matter.
We
are. You know I don't care that you think I'm great, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you hear that I said?
You have no sense that I'm not great,
right? You don't care? Did you care that I don't care? Yeah, it is. We're all terrified all the time. I mean, it's always, you know, I think you just don't.
Maybe you're better at hiding it than we are.
I don't know. I think we're good at distracting ourselves, or I'm not 100% sure. All I know is that
it's great. Since we started with about two people in in the room, and about every 7 minutes, somebody else comes in.
Well, that'll be the comedy of this, is that one at a time, like pretty soon there's going to be 30 people in here.
It'd be like the sketch of getting into the mini clubman.
And then you and I will have to make love in front of them.
Again.
I mean, there were only two people here the last time. But, you know, that's why it's so interesting to see and why, you know, your career has been so interesting. Because jumping to a show like Bastard Executioner, which is much more... I mean, that's much more intense.
Yes.
I mean, True Blood had its intensity, of course.
Yeah.
But this is a very intense, you know. And I would say loosely based on the Welsh Rebellion, would you say?
Yeah. Yeah. There's when Kurt started creating this thing, he was completely working within an English context, and they went on location scouts. There are more castles per square mile in Wales than there is anywhere else in the world, and so. There were sort of tax breaks and advantages to doing it in Wales. Kurt and Paris Barclay were touring around Wales looking at all these castles, and then which made Kurt then go away and start looking up the history. And he just went, let's make it in Wales. Let's make it about the Welsh Rebellion. And because there is this, you know, there is a roughness between England and Wales and England and Scotland and England and Ireland, which you, and England and Australia and England and New Zealand and England and anywhere that has to be seen to be believed. You know, I segue here, but I was in Australia doing something like 10 years ago, and I went to the Ashes. Do you know what the Ashes are?
No.
Since like the 1850s, Australia have been playing England at cricket every 2 years, and it's in Australia 1 year, and then, you know, 2 years later it's in England, and it goes across, and it's called the Ashes, and it's a 5-match series, and it's massive in our culture. And so I went to see the first day of the Ashes thinking that all my friends, the Australians who I love, you know, they hate us more than I have ever seen anybody hate anything until I was in Wales. And I love the Welsh. They hate us, you know. And it's like, it's a really interesting thing. It's like, if England get knocked out of the Rugby World Cup, as they just did, my diversion will go to Wales, because Wales are still in it. Scotland is still in it. So let's support them. The Welsh or the Scots or the Australians or the New Zealanders will support anybody. Rather.
It doesn't sound reciprocal at all.
A friend of mine, I was doing a TV show in Scotland during the 98 World Cup football now, soccer. And England were playing Argentina. And it was the semi-final or the quarter-final, I think it was semi. And I get taken into this pub that night by a Scottish friend. And he's got his coat done up.
Oh, no.
And I walk in, I'm the only English, I know I'm going to be the only English guy there. Every single person in the pub, including the barman, including the security, all had Argentina tops.
Oh.
Everybody.
Shit.
Everybody. The whole of Scotland basically turns out and, you know.
You can get fucking murdered.
Yeah.
Like, it's intense.
Rhys Ifans, once, I did a job with Rhys 25 years ago, and he once took me to this pub in Carnarvon, and he said, this is a Welsh heartland pub. You're not going to speak at all to me. Don't even open your mouth.
You're mute.
So I just got splattered at the bar, and I was like his mute friend. And I just got being given beer. Keep quiet.
Could you fake the Welsh accent?
I've got better at it, and I really don't want to do it now.
No, you don't have to do it now.
One of the worst auditions I ever did was doing Welsh, and with a director that I absolutely adored, who said, you can do Welsh, you can do anything. Come and do, you know, this thing. And give me something to read.
We have no anything. Written words.
Anything.
Everyone's rifling
quick,
for their...
Quick, a book.
Okay, this is...
You're reading from Felicia Day's book.
You're never weird on the internet. Okay, so... All right, sword boy. What? This is going to be so bad. Okay. So I just got to get myself into it. All right. Nothing got friendly. It's terrible already. I can't even do my impression badly because I've been away for like 2 days and I've lost it. And all my Welsh friends were going, actually, it's getting better, you know. Your Welsh is getting better. Hang on. You've got to think of a word to get you into it. All right, think of Matthew Rhys, all right? Nothing got friendlier between us after that, but he showed us me like an MMA fighter again, and I never... And it goes...
within, it goes into Gandhi?
Within about 17 words, it is Gandhi. And I was sitting in this audition, sweating bullets like a racehorse, and Carl was going, "Go on, you can do it, you can do it." And I did my line, and I literally got to about the seventh word and had turned into an Indian rickshaw driver, and I just went, "Thank you," and I got up and I walked out. It's the shortest and worst audition I've ever had.
Did you talk to the director afterwards?
Like, he was like, "Come back and have another go." I was like, "No, you're good.
Try it
you're
again
right.
with less vowels this time."
It was awful. And I, if I spend anywhere for any time, I can usually get an accent. The hardest one is Geordie, Newcastle. And I was doing this gig in Newcastle, and I'd said to this guy, Gavin Kitchen, who is a wonderful, lovely, lovely actor, and I said to him, "How can I get the Geordie accent? It's really, really tough. And it's notoriously the toughest in the English dialect." And he said, "I'll teach you a phrase that my nan, you know, said when I was last home with her. This is something that she said to me." And it goes like this. It goes, "Eow, Gavin, I was stuck in that doctor's surgery for 3 hours and they didn't even think to give us a cup of tea. I was spitting feathers."
It goes in so many weird, unpredictable places.
So that the little phrase is, "Eow, Gavin." E is like, "Hey."
Yeah.
"Gavin, I was stuck in the doctor's surgery for 3 hours
mm-hmm.
and they didn't even think to give us a cup of tea. I was spitting feathers." Right?
Angry.
"I was spitting feathers." Yeah, like, my mouth's so dry from shouting that... I'm spitting feathers.
Well, maybe it was literal, and that's why she was in surgery. They were trying to figure out...
That's right. They were trying to work out why all the feathers were in the back of her throat.
Yeah, she'd swallowed a goose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is something that...
That's an interesting thing. I never thought of that.
Never even had a cup of tea to wash it down.
But I worked out that the way to get into Geordie, right, is... And you can sort of do it. It's kind of got this, like, weird sort of thing like that. And I'm not pretending I'm great at it, but I'm not bad at it. Is you just say, "Winona Ryder." And it gets you
Winona
there.
Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder.
Winona Ryder.
There you go, you're a Geordie.
Winona Ryder. I would just say
I have not
the
found the actress that helps me get into the Welsh dialect yet.
I don't know.
Raquel Welsh?
No.
That was genius. That was genius. Can somebody open the can for a minute? Applause.
I'll take it.
I mean, it's strange... to when the dialect is different, the colloquialism, when you're trying to learn the colloquialisms in addition to sussing out what even the sounds are.
Yeah.
Especially.
But it's like anything. When you actually go to the place and actually spend some time in that environment, it just starts coming in the end. You know, you have to, it's like if you're learning a language, the best way to learn a language is to go and sit in that place, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I'm a bit of a parrot. I don't mean to do it, but I end up sort of sounding like the people. It's completely patronizing.
But that's part of your, you know, that's your mutant power as a performer. You got to go in and assimilate.
Well, yeah, you do. And then hopefully you get to a point where you're just not even recognized.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, in any way, you're just part of the fabric of the place.
I remember, I don't know, maybe like 97, 96, 97, I went to the Fringe Festival.
Oh, it's great, isn't it, in Edinburgh?
It was amazing. And, but... You know, I went to see a Scottish comic, and not only did I not really understand what he was saying,
yeah.
I didn't understand any of the... I mean, it was just... It was so fast-moving, and it was like, "Where are the Flatlanders at? Oh, yeah, goat huggers!" And everyone went crazy, and I'm like, "What is a goat hugger? I don't know who's a Flatlander." Like, I didn't understand the words or the references or what any of the...
Yeah.
And I felt so... You know, I think because we assume we speak a semblance of a similar language, we all communicate together all the time. It's like, no. At that moment, I was like, I'm incredibly foreign.
Yeah.
And I really don't understand what's happening.
It's a great language, though, isn't it?
It's
I wonder if it was Ed Byrne that you
I don't
saw.
Know.
That was pretty good, by the way.
No, I don't know. It was mid to late 90s. 96, 97.
Yeah, there's a great comic called Ed Byrne who's quite. He's actually become slightly, to make himself sort of understood, there's a slightly, like, you know, he's become a little bit softer over the years. It's a little bit nicer now, you know.
Who did I see? I saw Daniel. Daniel Kitson.
Kitson. I was going to say Daniel Kitson.
I saw Daniel Kitson, I think, in a very, if I'm remembering correctly, in a really small little tiny theater.
He's a genius.
He was brilliant. He did an entire, I think this was Kitson, he did an entire set while he was eating biscuits with tea, and then as soon as he finished the biscuits, I think he walked off stage. Yep. Like, it was just his whole set was the amount of time it took for him to get through the biscuits and the tea.
Back like 25 years ago, I used to go to this place called the Canal Cafe Theatre, and it was hosted by a comic called John Maloney, who became a friend of mine, and people used to go and try stuff out there. And so Joe Brand, who started Getting On, I don't know if you've seen that on HBO, great show.
Oh, right, yeah.
She started there. Well, no, didn't start there, but they would do tryouts. And I saw Eddie Izzard there before Eddie had become his thing. And he was just a sort of, he was a kind of normal stand-up at one point. There wasn't that kind of surrealistic thing. But because we were in this club where anything flew, that was with like 60 people in the audience. I think it was Eddie came on with like a fire extinguisher or he saw a fire extinguisher and he just read the instructions on the fire extinguisher. And it is one of the pieces of genius that you know, that one sort of associates with him, where the one idea of one instruction on the thing sort of started a whole 20 minutes of, I wonder if that means that if you went to, so, you know, and it just flew. And seeing that genesis of him becoming who he was was just extraordinary, because he didn't start that way.
But
and
finding,
people would come to that club and fail, but it was a really warm crowd. So they'd kind of come back the following week and try something else. And because of the 60 people who wanted it to work, it sort of would become where everybody's like generously kind of lifting them
well,
up.
Well, it's all that, you know, it all depends on the deal that you make with the audience. If the audience understands the deal, if they understand this is an experimental place, they're going to be cooler about trying stuff. If you go to a regular club and people are having to buy 2-drink minimums and they're, you know, they expect solid written jokes, or they don't, they get very, it's sort of like, you know, they're customers at a department store, and you better have the thing they're looking for. Yeah. You're going to fucking hear about it.
Yeah.
But it's so great to watch, to be around comedy long enough to see when someone finds their thing, like, oh my God, I saw that happen.
That feeling of,
Because it is a relationship that's formed.
Have you ever seen a guy called Boothby Graffo?
No.
Boothby came on with an alarm clock one day and just put the alarm clock on and said, right, you've got 10 minutes. And he said, you know, the inside of an alarm clock. He'd never done this before. It was just like, he talked about the inner workings of the alarm clock. And as soon as the alarm went off, he walked off. And it was brilliant.
That's fantastic.
It was so funny and just brilliantly inventive. And yeah, I love that. I'm so in awe of that, the balls to go and do something like that, you know.
But you could.
John Maloney used to do this thing with the A to Z, which is, you know, it was the how to get around London.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd open it up and pick a road and go, right, how are we going to get to this road then from where we are now? It goes, I have to go to page 64 now. Hang on a minute. And he built this whole thing around. And every week he would do, where should we go this week?
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's just brilliant. And he'd talk about things that happen on the road on the way there, you know.
It's harder to do that in more mainstream clubs, but that's why the smaller clubs are so special. Where you can experiment. I saw Mitch Hedberg once at Largo. His whole bit was that he had written a menu on spec, and so he brought his spec menu on stage, and he just basically read a menu from top to bottom.
Yeah. And it's genius, and you can't bottle it. You don't know what it is.
No, he probably wouldn't be able to do that. There are, you know, maybe a handful of rooms where he could get. Well, by the time he got famous, he could do that because people knew what he was about.
Yeah.
But before that, there's only a handful of rooms where you can really do weird stuff like that, and people are on board. Otherwise, you lose them, and the people are like, why are you reading his menu? You know, like, they don't, you know, like, fucking just go with it.
Yeah.
I mean, some audiences don't understand that if they just give 10%, the reward is enormous.
Absolutely.
You just got to, did you do a lot of live theater stuff?
Yeah.
And what
did I do it or did I go to it?
No, do you go? Do you do a lot of theater currently?
I had about 18 years off, and I did some a couple of years ago, and I'm planning to do some again.
What's your favorite part about it? What's your favorite part about doing live theater?
None of it. Oh, that's my favorite bit of it. None of it. No. I grew up doing theater, and I absolutely it was the thing that made me. The most visceral kind of feeling that I've probably have ever had in my life was experiences on stage. And there is something about that heartbeat that, you know, when you're in the moment of walking on and then your heartbeat slows down again and you realize that you're in the place that you're supposed to be, that's a joyous moment. And there is also a moment as well where the fear, and it's the same moment, but it's where the fear suddenly becomes, instead of the camera looking at you, you're looking back out again somehow. Yeah. And you're not worried about the next, whatever happens next. It's an incredible feeling. And again, difficult to bottle.
Sure. Because when you're doing television, you got the safety net. You know, you can do it a bunch. You have to do it a bunch a lot of the times.
Well, I think often when you're in the middle of something and it goes in a different way to the way that you'd rehearsed it, that will, just by necessity, inform what happens next. And purely because it didn't go quite how you'd expected it to before, it then changes what's coming after it. And that's hard to replicate on screen.
Sure. I am trying to figure out, going back to the earlier accent talk, so you're English, your wife is from New Zealand.
She was born in Canada and went to New Zealand when she was four.
When she was four. So what accent do your kids have?
We don't let them speak, really. It's so much easier.
They just pretend to be dad at a Welsh bar.
At a Welsh bar.
Yeah.
Don't speak.
We speak in other accents. In fact, at the moment, there's a lot of... there's a lot of English at the moment because we've just spent 6 months, you know, in between England and Wales. And there's occasionally, you know, little bits of Kiwi come in.
Just ekes in just a little
bit. Yeah, you know, it's going to be odd for them because, they're American.
Yeah.
They're our anchor babies, you know. The only reason we had them was so that we could stay here in your beautiful country.
Aren't they twins?
They are.
Yeah. So
we got one each.
You got one each.
Yeah.
You're totally covered.
Totally covered.
I mean, it is. I'm sure that they will be influenced by whatever their peer group is.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's
plus that weird twin language that no one else can understand.
But that's just more of like a like it's mostly nonverbal.
Those videos of those kids doing that, those twins doing that, is like something from like some Stephen King novel, isn't it?
It is creepy. I guess it does make sense, but it still is creepy.
There's just they don't even talk, our guys. I mean, they obviously talk to us, but they don't talk to each other. They don't need to. There is a sense of just knowing.
But it's interesting though when you have
like parrot each other like raptors?
Like raptors.
Yeah.
Not stegosauruses.
you gotta be the alpha.
Yeah.
But I'm curious what the experience for twins of the same gender are versus when they're different, you know, when there's a gender line between them.
Well, when they're different, they have rings and then they activate higher.
One of my favorite things
is,
you know, one of our kids is dark and the other one's blonde and they do not look alike at all. And one of, you know, when they were like in the pram, in the stroller, you know, people going, "Oh my God, they're beautiful." And Anna going, "Thank you." And, "Are they twins?" And she'd go, "Yeah. Are they identical?" And she'd go, no, they're not identical. But they're born at the same time, right?" "Yep, yeah. Yep. So they're not identical?" And I would go, "Well, there's always the penis and vagina issue." And then people still go, "Yeah, no, I know, but are they identical?"
You can see that they're not identical. Yeah. Use your eyes.
I love it.
They're fraternal twins. Yeah. That's not
amazing.
That's so great. Yeah. Well, I mean, that having to answer questions their entire lives. I mean, that right there. Was one of you adopted? No, we're just the same. It's just kind of how it works.
Do you feel things that he feels?
Did she know? How soon into the pregnancy did she know these are going to be twins? Did they tell you?
There's a cool story actually about that. My oldest friend, who I grew up with, is a bit of a medium. That's a
like
cue
a
for
Long
a gag.
Island psychic, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cue for
that's
gag. For
I turned to you then.
It's a cue for a small or a large gag.
Right.
Yeah.
But he is. And what's interesting about him is that he's a very, you know, he's very normal sort of working class dude who, you know, left school having got brilliant qualifications and became a hod carrier. You know, which is somebody who carries bricks, you know, for a bricklayer.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have gone to university and he chose to become a hod carrier. And then he sort of drove a forklift truck. And so that's just giving you an idea of who he is.
Sure.
And I went off and did something completely different, but he's still my best mate. And so the last person that you would expect to turn around and become somebody who would predict shit, you know, just not the average kind of guy that you would think that would do that. You know, he doesn't wear a scarf and have earrings or a crystal ball or anything. And but over the years, I've sort of just come to rely on him at certain points. And the day that we'd found out we were pregnant, Anna, who didn't believe it at all to begin with about Alan, we woke up in the morning and she said, "I'm surprised you haven't heard from Alan." And because we hadn't told a soul. And I said, "Actually, I think he's texted. Hang on." Because when I'd woken up, I'd seen that he'd texted. I hadn't looked at it. And I got the phone open and I looked at it. And he said, "I don't know if this is going to help you, Smoovy." He calls me Smoovy. "I don't know if this is going to help you, Smoovy. But I had a dream about you and Anna on a beach with a little boy and girl running towards you. Take it easy. See you at the football, you know." and I swear to God. And we kind of went, "Oh." And, you know, cut to about 2 hours later, her OBGYN calls up and says, "I need to talk to you because there's the blood ratio kind of thing is really, really high. I'd like you to come back in again." We went back in again. He said, "There's another one in there." And Anna said, "Yeah, I know." And he said, "Do you want to know what they were?" Because she was about 5 or 6 weeks or something. He said, "Do you want to know what they are?" And she said, "We know." And so he did the thing with the ultrasound. Said it's a boy and a girl, and she said, "Yeah, we know."
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, and I swear to God, it's a really odd thing because I grew up totally non-believer, just like live for the now,
right?
And he was the one who sort of changed all that.
That's crazy.
And
that's a show too, a bricklaying medium, a guy who has that accent.
He kills everybody, and then he puts a brick wall up. He can wall them up. It's fantastic.
Oh my God, you just reminded me of I just read an article this morning. There was an article at the top of Reddit today about this guy named H.H. Holmes, who was one of the most prolific – that sounds like a compliment, but he's one of the most prolific serial killers of the 19th century.
Right.
And he basically built this murder hotel.
Wow.
Where people – he bought this drugstore. He worked at a drugstore and he bought it, and it was this building in Chicago, and he had rigged up different rooms with different methods for killing guests. It was a hostel. And so people would come in. There was one room that had a gas line in it. There were these other – and it was relatively innovative. There were other rooms where people could get hanged or cut. And he would
innovate.
He would basically
– "Hello, I'd like room 4, please. I'd like to hang.
Can I have a hanging today? No, I think you're more of a crushed by bricks." and he would skin the bodies and sell the skeletons to science. And he killed so many people. It was just like, "Oh, yeah, there was a time when things were just not traceable." Because he didn't get caught for a really long time.
Yeah.
But
have you guys seen Sicario?
No. How is it?
There's that moment happens in Sicario.
You liked it? You liked it. Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good.
What are you watching? What else are you watching?
Narcos.
Mm-hmm.
Bloodline.
Yep.
What else? I really like Getting on HBO. Mm,
yep.
I've already mentioned it. I think it's hilarious, and I'm looking forward to that because the third season's about to come up. We've been away, so a lot of the things that are on American TV at the moment, you can't get, you know, British TV. What else have we been watching? Well, I'm really jet lagged, so we watched Straight Outta Compton at about 3 o'clock this morning.
Oh, nice!
Yeah, 3 o'clock this morning. That was my.
When did you get back?
Got back on Sunday night.
Oh, so you're still... Oh,
we're
in that
kind of waking up at 2 o'clock going, hi! How you doing?
Want to go for a run?
Yeah!
Because we're up! Going to be exhausted at 4 p.m.?
Yeah. And espresso seems like a really great idea.
Oh, you know. It helps for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, the travel. So are you going back or are you here for...
No, I'm here now. Here now. Finished.
Oh, show's good. Done.
Yeah.
Good, good, good. You're done. Do you
yeah,
know?
So part two, you know, I can come back tomorrow. I can come back. I can come back every day.
Every single day.
Yeah.
You ever think maybe like, you just want to do like a simple comedy with no elaborate costumes and no murders and no...
You know, it's becoming more and more attractive the more I think about it. But, you know, the chance... we had an incredible time in Wales. The whole family were together. I took the dogs to Wales as well. And we had this little cottage in a beautiful little village, and it was completely idyllic. So if we're lucky enough to get a pickup, I'll be very happy to go back there again.
Oh, that's cool. What do you guys do in your off time? Is it you're just focusing on the kids, or do you go on road trips, or what do you like to do?
We've got a little house in the country, which is my sort of dream place, and Anna's actually. But we've got a production company, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So we're developing a whole bunch of stuff. We've got films, TV dramas, documentary. We've got some really interesting stuff that's kind of all bubbling around. I've got something with Dennis O'Hare, who's, you guys probably know, he was Russell Edgington, and he's in American Horror Story playing Elizabeth Taylor as we speak. And he's written a script that I'm going to be directing next year, which is a film. And
that sounds cool.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of kind of bits and pieces.
Isn't it great that we're sort of in this period where you don't just have to be a performer, that you can be a producer, you can be a writer, you can direct, you can do a million different things.
I feel like it's easier here than it is. I think it's easier now than it was, but at home in England, everybody really like to pigeonhole you. And I do think it's changing. You know, so if you're an actor, you're an actor. If you decide to write something or you decide to direct something, it's all like, oh, look at her, who does she think she is? You know? And now it's becoming more and more sort of acceptable.
I'm spitting up feathers.
I'm spitting feathers. And I remember being in France doing ADR on a film that I'd done. And one of the people in the film had told, you know, the guys in the studio that I'd started out in musicals, and they said, oh, we should record an album. Let's make an album. And I said, what? And let's get some musicians. We make an album. And they were totally serious. And what I love about that idea in sort of French culture is that if you're an artist, whether it be a painter or whether it be a comedian or whether it be a singer, because you're an artist, the word artist means you can do anything.
Sure.
And it's totally acceptable.
What would your album be if you were going to record an album?
Bricked up corpses. You could tell a story of each person in song, like a song cycle.
That'd be amazing.
Right?
Like those old song poems. Oh, it's perfect.
Yeah. Just be like the new Sweeney Todd. It'd be great.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you get a chance, H.H. Holmes, it's a fascinating
I'm going to look
story.
It up.
It's so fascinating because... He was like, how the fuck did he get away with this for so long? He was like, all these people are just disappearing, and no one...
They couldn't make the DNA evidence stick.
No, they couldn't...
It was during the Chicago World's Fair, so people were coming and going all along.
Oh, I've heard about
There's
that.
There's that amazing book, The Devil in the White City.
Yes.
If you haven't read that, do go get that book right now.
I got tons of time. I'm going to go read that book.
Let's all read it now on radio.
Page one.
Yes.
Well, we did that for my show at midnight. We, our crew, team, read Moby Dick start to finish on Periscope. It took 29 hours.
That's awesome.
I think. Yeah, and people would come in shifts, like random people would swing in and read for like 20 minutes.
Oh, my God, that's fantastic.
Cover to cover, Moby Dick.
I love that.
It was fun, and three people watched all 29 hours. There were three people in the world who watched all 29 hours.
That's incredible.
And we gave them awards and accolades. That's what's so strange. I mean,
that's art, baby.
It's art. Come on. It's like the Andy Kaufman, you know, thing. But are you guys active? Are you on social media at all?
We are. We joined about a year ago, I guess. Maybe a little bit longer than that now. We do that now. You know, I'm still sort of alien to it, truthfully. I sort of dip in and go, oh, that's what's happening. And then I dip back out again. And then next time I go on, like there's fans going, he was here, he was here, did you see him, did you see him, he was here, oh my god. And then I'm always sort of reacting to what happened before.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand. I think the very first time that I turned it on, I was so overwhelmed by the so-and-so's following you, so-and-so's following you, so-and-so's following you. And I'd given my like normal email address.
Right.
And it just was, so I just turned all notifications off.
That's wise.
And now it's a little bit more.
It's a little more manageable. Dope. Well, your kids, they must be what, three or four?
Yeah,
yeah, three. I'd say within a year or so, they're going to start.
Oh, they're all over it. And I've got older kids as well. And, you know, we're surrounded by it. I love it. But I think my problem is that I'm a total addict. So I'm playing this game called 2048 at the moment that has just completely taken my life over.
Is that like threes?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it took my life over. So I just can't do it. If I spend any time doing that, I don't do anything else.
For how long?
And that's the same with Twitter and Instagram. And it's, you know, I love photography, but if the cool thing with Instagram is like, if you find somebody, a photographer that you like, and then look who they follow.
Right.
So then suddenly you're down this rabbit hole of cool street photography or whatever it is.
And then your kids haven't eaten in 3 days.
What kids? You know? It's like the kids have disappeared completely. He looks really thin. Who?
I don't. Look at these pictures. Daddy's busy.
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? It's really hard once you sort of go down it because it's just endless.
Well, it does play into the innate need we as humans have to distract ourselves from things.
Yes.
And when you go somewhere where it's not as readily available, it takes a couple of days to shake it off. But when you do, then you go, oh, this isn't so bad. Ah, this feels, oh, this is what pioneers felt like, even though it isn't really. This is what pioneers felt like.
I just walked to the store.
Yeah, oh.
And I didn't photograph it.
Right, exactly. It's like,
I feel like Scott of the Antarctic.
Our version of pioneers is like, I went to Whole Foods.
Yeah.
And I bought tomatoes.
And I didn't take a photograph of one tomato.
No, you'd have to grow your own food and contend with weather and invaders. But
well, I think as a pioneer, you're the invader.
You are the invader. Yeah, in a way, you are.
A little social conscience there for you.
You are the parasite.
I want you to know. This ain't our country.
Take that, America. But then you immediately get back, and then you just get sucked right back in immediately. It's just scroll.
Yeah.
It's so bad. Don't ever.
A friend of mine's got a really great idea for an app, which is, it's called Doctor No Doctor. You take a picture of, if you get a scratch or if you hurt yourself, you take a picture of it and you put it up, and then you ask, is doctor or no doctor? And people come back and, you know, it's like literally swipe left for doctor, swipe right for no doctor. And after about an hour, you work out whether you need to go to the doctor or not.
By the way, if you feel dizzy
you
in that time.
Died in that hour.
Yeah. The doctor, yeah. The app hasn't told me what to do.
Exactly.
I think there are apps where you can chat with a doctor and send them pictures.
I'm sure there is.
Of stuff.
Have you seen Sit or Squat?
No.
Sit or Squat's great. It's an app of every single toilet in America, so that when you're in a, you know, like you're going on a freeway and you're dying to go to the toilet, you go on to Sit or Squat and it works like a Google map, and it will tell you every single toilet's rated and there's a picture of each toilet.
There's a
photograph of the toilet and how dirty it is, and it's rated on the filth factor, which is why it's called Sit or Squat.
That is fantastic.
Genius, right?
What if they could take the picture on a bad day?
Yeah.
What if they...
Yeah, after the guy, you know, hasn't filled in his thing on the side of the door saying I was here.
He hasn't done his check, so it just looks like a car crash. And and maybe... You don't know. What if the quality control on Sit or Squat is?
That's a good idea.
Now I got to download that. As soon as I'm done talking this, I got to download it. I do not like... I'm not a good public restroomer.
Can you not do it at home? Do you have to do it at home?
The
sitting aspect of it?
Yes. And my fiance preferably is not.
Your imaginary fiance.
Shut up. She's real. She's just in Canada, okay? She preferably is not in the... As a matter of fact, oh, man, we were in a hotel last week and... Nature had a plan that I had to deal with.
You had your little chaos theory?
Nature finds a way. Nature finds a way. Nature was about to find a way. Mm-hmm. And I was so nonchalantly like, we're going to go to breakfast. I was like, oh, you know, you go down. I'm going to catch up. And then I just saw the realization wash across her face, which she thought was really funny. And then it was like, oh, are you going to poop? Like, stop it. Don't say that to me. Just go, please. Don't turn this into a thing. Please.
Yeah,
it was very embarrassing.
Yeah,
very embarrassing. But you have to get over that when you're married, I assume, because you know, especially when you have kids pooping.
No,
all over.
I think there's certain, you know, I famously, you get asked such stupid questions when you've just had babies, and you know, so what they like changing a diaper, you know, and
really arousing.
And sometimes I say things that are slightly inappropriate just to get the conversation sort of changed. And I went, I love poo. It's all good. And so, you know, whenever one of our kids needs a diaper change, Anna is always, you love poo. It says in People magazine, so you can change the thing.
I was being sarcastic.
Yeah.
That meant you love poo. No, you love poo.
But I think there's certain aspects of relationships that, you know, that stay apart.
I think that's good.
Yeah.
I think that's good. I have a friend who's born.
I don't make her change my diapers, if it's what I'm saying.
You need to change your own diaper.
Yeah.
Any grown man needs to change his own diaper, and that's how it is.
Mom. I call my mom in England to get her to fly over and do it.
I've seen those. There was a really weird fetish show on. It was like a Real Sex when HBO. I don't know if they're still doing those, but.
Sure you do.
I don't know. We always watched Real Sex thinking like, oh yeah. And then you're like, oh, Real Sex is not I don't want to see that. Because it was basically always just like hippies in the woods trying to make each other have orgasms through telepathy. And you're like, all right, well, that's
German swingers.
Yeah. But there was one, and it was this old German woman had found this German guy in his mid-40s to basically, it was infantilism, like he basically pretended to be a baby, and she took care of this old German woman.
Yep.
But what they never explained, which I think was the most important question, was how the fuck did these people find each other? Because this was in the 90s, so it wasn't like there wasn't just an internet that they could go find each other.
There's a lot of notice boards
outside retirement homes. And she would change his diapers, and he would cry, and she would...
Yeah.
And there was something so...
That's kind of like my marriage.
You just lie there and cry until she sorts it out.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. It's the last time,
Stevie.
It's the last time.
Come on.
Come on now. What are we doing? What have we said?
I don't know.
But what are you? What is your favorite part about being a dad? What do you look forward to the most with your kids?
I don't know. They're so funny. There's nothing funnier than your own kids. It's not funny. It may not be funny to anyone else, but there's just those beautiful moments where they do something that is new to them, new to you. You know, it's finding, I don't know, elements of yourself from when you were young, I suppose.
Right.
That they re-represent and show you again. And just that kind of joy in life and beauty.
Hope for the future, so on and so forth.
And seeing flowers for the first time and that kind of thing is just it's extraordinary. And you know, and I'm sure that, you know, those of you who've got kids will know this, but every time you say, oh, I love that age, you know, the next one's just as great. And my 15-year-old played a lick for me on the guitar the other day that blew my mind, because it was Lightning Hopkins, who I adore, and who he now loves because I sort of played it to him, and he played Stool Pigeon Blues for me, and I was, because it's hard, man, it's hard, I couldn't play it, and he played it, and he learned it because he knows that I love it.
Oh, that's awesome.
Unbelievable, right? And you kind of, it takes you back a bit, because there's elements in it that you'd never expected, and I think it's the surprises that
I made you.
Yeah.
That's
what Hitler's parents felt too. Surprises.
Just all surprises.
He was
all
a huge Lightning Hopkins fan.
A little known fact.
But he would just paint bad paintings of Lightning Hopkins.
Yeah.
Got kicked out of art school.
Yeah.
Whole thing.
My favorite thing about the whole would you kill baby Hitler thing that New York Times, was it New York Times Magazine? Was that who it was?
Not sure.
A couple weeks ago, Let's say it's New York Times Magazine. They posted a poll on Twitter. Would you kill baby Hitler? If you had the opportunity, would you go back and kill baby Hitler? It was huge. It trended for days.
But you wouldn't know it was baby Hitler, would you?
Well, if you knew with your knowledge, say, I think that you're supposing that you know who baby Hitler is. You can go back in time. You have the opportunity. And one person had the most perfect answer where they just said, I would kidnap him and raise him in a loving environment. Like, why was murdering? Like, maybe we just change his environment and show him a different life. And why do we have to fucking murder him? Such a strange thing. That'll be your next fascination, is polls on Twitter. You can create polls where people vote yes or no.
I did one for which show has the greater sexual tension, Property Brothers or American Pickers.
That's really, really good.
And I had 2,000 votes, and it was 51% to 49%
for
Property Brothers.
For Property Brothers.
Wow.
Jonathan and Drew were supposed to be on the podcast a couple days ago, and then I had to work, and they couldn't come on.
I get a bit horny watching American Pickers.
I mean, Frank and Mike really seem like there's something going on.
There is. The way they smile at each other in the truck.
In that van.
When Frank finds an oil can, it's like, oh my God, we're going to have to shoot that again. I just came. Yeah.
That's the only poll I ran.
My first poll was today. It was, should I use the poll function on Twitter?
Oh, and then it could have been more clever.
63% said yes.
Hang on.
Is there something that I've missed? There's a poll.
If you're verified on Twitter, you can run polls. Essentially, you can just
create choices. You create what the two choices are, and people can vote, and then you can see what the stats are.
Yep. Oh my God!
Yeah. It is. You'll get addicted to that.
Shall I go down the rabbit hole? Yes or no?
Yes or no? Yes.
Yeah.
Most people will say yes.
Yes.
You've been delightful times a million. This was so, we're already more of an hour.
Have we?
Yes.
And I didn't even know it started.
No.
Brilliant.
Okay, we're gonna start now.
Okay.
Bastard Executioner. Tell me about Kurt Sutter.
So, Bachelor Executioner is on
Tuesday nights, 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
I don't know when this goes out, but this evening is episode 8. the episode 10, which is our finale, has the most extraordinary battle sequence that I think anybody's been lucky enough to shoot. And, you know, it's like a dream when you're... When I grew up, all I wanted to do was sort of, you know, be a cowboy and ride horses and shoot, you know... Native Americans. And,
as you do.
You know, no, I didn't. I actually Tonto was my hero, just to clear that up.
Johnny Depp's Tonto, it's weird.
Yeah, I just had this foreshadowing of what it was going to be like. I was so excited. I couldn't
wait. Fuck that Army Hammer, I'm into Tonto.
I couldn't wait to see that museum sequence where he does that mime. So, you know, when you, as an actor, get a chance to do those things where you're sort of riding a horse on a beach and you're fighting with swords and doing all of that stuff and people are falling over and, you know, that's when I kind of go, this is what I do for a living.
Yeah.
And episode 10, the finale, has a great bunch of that, and it's really cool.
It is so incredible to see where television has gone.
Yeah.
To the depths at which, I mean, it's,
I mean,
film.
Even
every film,
even
every week's a movie,
even just to you know, just it, just to be boring and technical for a little minute, even to the stage of, we had a drone on that shoot, and
well, that's not period correct. I'm sorry.
That's how the Welsh won the revolution.
So that we were shooting on this section of sand where there was some, like, a sort of natural lake, and so the drone goes up and over the lake, and there's thousands and thousands of pounds worth of equipment, and it's hovering above the lake, literally a foot off of the lake, and there's this sequence which I won't spoil, but there's a sequence with horses and a charge and, you know, a battle, and suddenly this thing swoops up and starts flying towards the horses, and these are stunt horses, and then just flies above them, and the camera sort of turns upside down, and you're like, you couldn't do that on a 150 million Scorsese shoot with 10 years ago. So there's these kind of things that you can do now, which are just sort of constantly breaking what it is that we do and love, and it's amazing to watch.
Well, as a director too, it's an exciting time. Because of the technological advancements, but also at the same time, you know, I almost feel like sometimes more choices isn't always better.
That is true. But if you look at something like Breaking Bad, where they kind of, they had these small cameras for the first time. We were shooting on film on True Blood. So we shot on film for the whole time up until the last season. And so you're still carrying around, you know, 400 feet of film when you're doing handheld, which obviously for the camera operator means that he's slightly encumbered by it. Whereas now, you know, we were using this thing called the Red Dragon. You'll probably know what a red camera is. The Red Dragon is like 65K.
Jeez.
So the amount of image that is in 1/1000th of a frame is more than is in, you know, a one piece of film. So you can do stuff that is extraordinary and it's this big. And so on Breaking Bad, they were doing things that had never been done before, like running and going between, you know, shooting from weird angles just because they can hold the camera up and do it. So yes, you don't need that stuff to tell a great story, but you can sometimes it can move the drama along in a way that is, you know, fascinating and something that we've never seen before. And I love the idea of that.
That's it. So, and have you made the official announcement to what the thing is that you're directing next year?
I mean, it's out there a little bit. I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's about an event that happened in Dennis's life about 5 years ago. And Dennis and I were working on a number of ideas and projects, and he's a wonderful writer. But truthfully, I wanted to work with him. I knew that I wanted to direct him in my first feature. Mm-hmm. I was directing him in season 5 of True Blood, just watching him, and he's miraculous. And, you know, he brings everybody's game up. In whatever job he's doing, he kind of brings the level up to a sort of different strata. And this event happened in his life, and we were working on something else, and he told me the story of this event, and I kind of went, I think that's the film. And 6 weeks later, he sent me a script, and it was on my doorstep, and we've been working on it ever since.
He's such a spectacular actor, too. That guy just, there's no, he really does everything. He really does every type of role. There's no one thing that
does. American Horror Story is a great example of what of Dennis's range. You know, he at the moment, he's playing Elizabeth Taylor.
Right.
And just jumps in, you know, feet first. And, you know, I love him. He's amazing.
That's fantastic. Well, it's really good to see you. And, you know, not one time did I awkwardly ask you to summon up Bill Compton's accent, which I was, you know, it was hard not to repeat it running around the house. Okay. Like, it's so hard not to do it.
Yeah. And it's, I love the Southern accent and the sort of layers within it. And there's one story that I'll tell that the very, very first time we were down in Louisiana, we'd shot the pilot before we did the exteriors for the pilot, and before it got picked up, and then we all went down to Louisiana to shoot them, and I'd already done some work on it and what I wanted it to sound like, and Anna and I and a couple of the other actors were having lunch at the Hilton in Shreveport, and I was sitting sort of watching these guys behind the counter, the food counter. We were the only people in there. And then this bus turned up. And we saw this bus turn up in the driveway of the Hilton and like 50 people come out. And this is mime, so it's not going to play very well on podcast. but basically, this guy's like looking at this magazine really slowly, licking his finger. And he does the slowest double take I've ever seen. He sort of senses something going on over there. And he looks over. He sees 50 people getting off the bus. He turns back to the page and then goes. And the speed with which it happened, which was 30 seconds, was so amazing. And that's where you realize that this kind of, there's no hurry.
No.
So what it means is that when you're doing an accent like that, you can just luxuriate in the joy of every word, you know.
You draw it out.
And it's kind of incredible to sort of have that.
Yeah, the Brits are good at the Southern accent.
Mm.
A lot of the Brits come over and they tackle the Southern accent beautifully. I feel like there are other.
I'm sensing that it's going to go that they don't do some of the other ones very well.
No, they're just, you know, it's, I think, in as much as the American ear can only hear so much, you know, with the regionalism.
Yes.
You know what's what. I think most Americans hear you know, Irish, Scottish, and then this generalized English accent, which is probably closest to like a London accent.
Yeah,
or a,
that's, true.
Or,
that's
or, true. Or a poshy kind of a, yes, I'm evil.
You tell the difference, though? I mean, I'm really interested to know. Can you tell the difference between somebody who, you know, who speaks very well like that and then somebody who talks like that?
Totally.
You can, because some people can't. Yeah. Some people don't hear it.
Right.
And, you know, the difference, and that's like obviously a very extreme version of like.
You just got to show them a Guy Ritchie movie and like, here are the various flavors of what you're going to see here. Yeah. But when you start getting really granular in terms of, you know, you can probably hear, oh, a person from this part of London sounds a bit different than a person from this.
And it really is like Pygmalion.
And
like,
I think we wouldn't be able
My
to
Fair
detect
Lady.
That.
You can literally do it road by road.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine was saying the other day that they can't. That they a Hispanic friend who can't watch Narcos because all the accents are wrong.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, because they're wrong. It's a Colombian playing a Mexican guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they it just doesn't sound right. It's wrong.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would drive
me. Plus, they'd probably be speaking Spanish.
Well, they are.
What?
Yeah, you just showed yourself up.
What? That's not right.
Some of the accents that I think are a little bit, you know, there's like. You know, Michigan, Wisconsin, you know, Michigan's different than Wisconsin, which is a little bit different than Chicago, which is, you know, then there's a general Midwest accent.
It's so much easier when you actually have a specific place.
Right.
Because the generic American accent that is the sort of homogenized American accent, unless the character's got something to pin something on the character, it's really hard to make that sound anything.
Well, yeah, because I think now the general American accent is a real dipshit sounding, like, oh my gosh, I mean, I talk like this and everything's upspeak, like when I hear people from Australia.
But that's a character. So that's something to hang your thing on, because immediately I can just start doing that, you know, and we're ordering Chilean sea bass. And so
don't get any on your yoga pants.
An arugula?
Yeah, it's the
arugula
best.
Always helps me get there.
It cleans you out. It totally just cleans you out. It is the best.
It flushes my pipes.
Do you want some juice? We'll get some juice. We'll go on a juice. We'll get on a juice
My
cleanse.
Lawyer's a juice.
What? No.
I'm sorry?
No.
Oh.
No, a juice. Not what? Different type
you
of cleanse.
You want to get some juice, right?
Different type of cleanse. Thank you. Why do those jokes always crack you up? I know you're a Jew. This is really funny. All right, good. We did it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Excellent.
Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Stephen Moyer!
Open the can.
Or Stephen Moyer. Did they say Moyer in French?
No, never heard that.
Okay, all right. I'm backing away slowly. Yeah. Seems I've done the equivalent of drifting into an Indian accent. Backing away slowly.
I thank you.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.